KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community station, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
We are kind of between elections, so I don't have to give you the nag. However, I will give you a swimwear PSA. This is from click2houston.com. The color of a child's swimwear could save their life, study says. The color of your child's swimsuit can play a huge role in preventing drowning incidents, according to a study. When most parents go shopping for their child's swimsuit, they usually pick the child's favorite color, cartoon character, or style and comfort. But a recent study conducted by Alive Solutions, Inc., a company that specializes in aquatic safety, reports that the color of the child's swimwear could make a difference in saving their life. The company put swimsuit colors to the test to see their visibility in both pools and open water. And there are photographs showing different colors under different circumstances. I recommend clicking on the article. What they found is that the top colors for visibility were neon yellow, neon green, and neon orange. White came in fourth place, but appeared more to be a light reflection or clouds on the surface and wouldn't stand out in a crowd. Neon pink did not perform well in lakes like it did in the white bottom of a pool environment, assuming it's a white bottom. All other colors disappeared quickly, and this was in only 18 inches of water. The company recommends bright and contrasting colors that can help people or lifeguards see if the child has gone underwater. I think this is a really useful, important article at the beginning of the swim season, and I strongly recommend that everybody look at this article, whether they have kids or we're only talking about adults, because adults drown too. Andrew?
Definitely. Because, and in some ways this makes sense, because neon yellow, green, and orange are all high visibility vest colors. So yeah, that makes sense that those would be the best colors for visibility.
And also keep in mind that it's very rare that you can see into water in ideal conditions. You know, we're not talking Bermuda placid clear. We're talking about wind ripples on the water would be enough to make it hard or impossible to see someone on the bottom. So visibility really does count.
Definitely.
Okay. For a little light news, League City City Council is always good for something interesting. They have approved residents keeping pigs as pets. Now, this is actually a follow-up on a story that we've looked at once or twice on this show. After weeks of debate, the League City City Council has made a decision on residents keeping pigs as pets. City Council voted unanimously May 24th to allow residents to keep pigs as pets with certain restrictions. Whether there would be any restrictions was actually one of the things they were debating. Pigs kept as pets must remain indoors, and any outdoor time must be brief, such as for the elimination of waste and exercise. Male pigs must be neutered, and female pigs must be spayed, despite the surgery to spay a pig being more complicated than neutering, according to League City documents. Pigs must also receive annual vaccinations and be microchipped. Outdoor areas for pigs must be cleaned daily. Council member Chad Tressler added additional requirements when making a motion to approve allowing pigs as pets, including the restriction that pigs cannot be taller than 26 inches at the top of their shoulder, which, if you think about it, is pretty big. No other size restrictions, including on weight, were made. City Council first voted in favor of a less restrictive version of the ordinance on April 26th, after it came back for a second and final reading on May 10th. But city council postponed it to get on the same page about certain restrictions. Council members expressed relief at having the issue behind them after weeks of discussion. Mayor Pat Hallisey said, "Thank God we're done with pigs." I'm sure that's how everybody feels, especially people that will be living next door to them, or maybe not so much. Mm. 26 inches at the shoulder is fairly tall. You can have a really heavy pig at 26 inches to the shoulder. So, you know, I forget the proper name for them. They have miniature pigs. Pigs are supposed to actually make good pets. Yeah. They're intelligent. They're affectionate. It's an excellent reason to consider going vegetarian. it is. I admit it. But, you know, to keep one in the house without a weight limit, 26-inch size limit, really will not do it. I mean, at that size, I think they could be upwards of 400 pounds.
Well, I mean, there are people who have pretty big dogs as well.
400-pound dogs. I mean, even Great Danes, St. Bernards, I don't think anything gets upwards of 200.
Well, there are bear dogs, which are not dogs crossed with bears, but are dogs meant for helping to hunt bears. That I've seen pictures of somebody I follow on social media has one, and that dog is pretty huge. So I don't know. I don't know exactly how big and how much the dog weighs, but I don't think it's totally out of the realm of possibility that somebody could have a pig that big in their house.
Well, let's put it this way. Think of the weight limits on a lot of furniture. And I think a lot of furniture maxes out at 250 to 300 pounds.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't let them on the furniture then.
well, at 400 pounds, are you going to argue with it?
That's a good point.
And, you know, when you have a piglet and, you know, you cuddle them and they're adorable and they make these cute little oink, 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 and then the thing gets to be an adult and it still thinks it's a piglet.
Mm.
I mean, we really need, well, not we necessarily, but I think potential pig owners that are considering them as household pets, I hope there aren't too many. I guess there must have been at least one person in League City that wanted a pig as a pet for reasons which we can only speculate upon.
Mm. Well, the good thing is that they can probably come back and adjust this ordinance as needed if it turns out that, yes, they need to ban weight, pigs over a certain weight or something as well.
But then what are you supposed to do if you have a pig over a certain weight? Send it to the slaughterhouse?
What are you supposed to do if you
rehome it?
What are you supposed to do if you move to a town that bans pigs as pets anyway, and you already have a pig?
Well, actually, that's still a real issue for some people when they have dogs or cats and they have to move to a new rental space and the landlord is really strict about not allowing pets. I mean, I try not to allow them, but, you know, it can be hard. But yeah, you know, you part with the pig just like you would part with a dog or a cat. Hopefully you would do so responsibly, whatever that would mean for a pet pig.
Mm, that or landlords could be a little less heartless and let pets happen.
I have to tell you, if I had a prospective tenant that looked like a really good prospective tenant, except that they had a 300-pound pig, that would be one heck of a pet deposit.
And that would be fair.
And
but at least you'd let them have it.
It would depend on the property. But yeah, of course, you know, it's not only the pet deposit. Technically, a tenant is responsible for damage to a property over and above normal wear and tear, even in excess of any deposits. Of course, collecting it is something else, but, you know, be that as it may. Okay, enough pigs. next story from HoustonPublicMedia.org. Houston's contract janitors are planning to strike if upcoming wage negotiations fail. The current contract will expire at the end of the month, leaving many janitors hopeful for an increase to their hourly minimum wage. Thousands of janitors in Houston could go on strike. The janitors do not work for the city, but they are the ones who clean the private office buildings around town. Right now, the average janitor at a private firm in Houston makes $10.75 an hour, according to the Service Employees International Union, which represents the janitors. The workers want a path to $15 an hour. I think I read somewhere that the last contract was like a max of $12. But that's not in this article. Inflation is crippling their ability to pay for everyday items like food and gas. The current contract for more than 2,800 janitors will have expired midnight Tuesday, so by the time you hear this, and workers said it could lead to a strike either way or in a few days. From my cursory research, this actually appears to be a broad-based strike threat, as my research showed that the same thing is occurring in other cities around the country. Andrew?
Hmm. I have seen some other articles. I think I saw an article from the Kron saying that this was mainly workers from like a handful of large firms in town, which would explain, you know, the 2,800 janitors. But also, like, I don't know if I've heard of it happening in other cities around the country. I wouldn't be surprised.
I did see articles. I don't remember which cities, but there were disparate cities kind of scattered around the country. So I guess it's an SEIU thing.
That could be it, because SEIU is a big union. But
yeah, probably an umbrella contract.
Yeah, but good luck to the workers. I hope they get all of their demands met with minimal with no pushback. Of course, how likely is that to happen? Well, that's what we have strikes for. So
yeah, I mean, there are very few jobs that are easy. Janitorial work is not among them.
Oh yeah.
Okay, our next story is actually something I found on nextdoor.com, and there is a link to the video that triggered my interest in this story, but you have to be on nextdoor.com. Basically, there was a bicycle event in the North Houston Heights, and there was a woman who was trying to make a left turn on Airline Drive. I can't tell you where on Airline Drive. And there was a massive group of bicyclists coming the other way. So she was trying to make a left turn, and she was in the turn lane. There were two lanes coming toward her, two lanes going with her. There were cyclists in the turn lane. There were cyclists that were doing wheelies in front of her and then veering around her into oncoming traffic. The other cyclists were basically taking up both lanes coming in the other direction. Like I said, if you can get on Nextdoor, there's a video. I've also referenced Texas Department of Transportation laws and regulations. There's a section there on how that applies to bicycles in the state of Texas. Municipalities will have their own modifications. I've also included a link to a video that runs about 4 minutes. Her video is about 40 odd seconds. There's another video I've linked to that I think you can just see on Facebook.
Yeah, I think so.
That actually shows like a 4.5 minute ride where it's a different group, I believe. We're not mentioning any names because we're not certain of what groups they were. So that's the reason. We think we know, but we're not sure. But in the longer video, you can see that they're going in the lane in the right direction. They're going in the lane in the wrong direction. They're going in the turn lanes. They're passing red lights. I mean, this is really a lawless group of cyclists. You know, I'd have to call them scofflaws. We looked at the regulations, I say we because I was reading it to Andrew. We looked at the regulations, and yeah, there are certain stipulations. Cyclists are supposed to stay in dedicated bicycle lanes if such are available, as long as those lanes are safe. In other circumstances, if it's a large group like this, if it's a two-lane road going in a certain direction, I would say make an effort to either stay in the bike lane or near the curb, which is the law, or at least only take up the one lane as opposed to take up the whole roadway. That slows traffic, but you're not actually obstructing it. I think one of the things here that struck me immediately, and I don't think I've changed my mind much, is the purpose of these large, large gatherings of cyclists where it can be hundreds or upwards of 1,000 cyclists in a group. I look at it as either it's a protest, cyclists reclaiming the road from motor vehicles, or it's a parade. If it's not a protest, then it's a gathering that has been to some level planned. And Andrew and I have kind of hashed this out, and I'm not going to speak for him, but I think we agree that on some level there was some kind of organization. And I think that they need to be responsible to police. I think they should have a police escort. I think they should have a permit either for a protest or a parade, whatever distinctions there are in the permitting process for that. Because essentially what they're doing, they're just riding bikes en masse as scofflaws, feeling like their numbers make them untouchable. Andrew, I'll let you pick it up from here.
Sure. I have seen both of those videos, one because the Facebook one is publicly viewable and the Nextdoor one because we had a video call and Mike filmed his screen for me. But in both of those videos, there are clear examples of cyclists just flouting the rules of the road and doing things that – this is what's important – doing things that put themselves and other people in danger. Now, I am not one to say follow the law because it's the law. I don't believe in that. I believe laws should only be followed if they're just and they make sense.
And equally enforced for that matter.
Sorry?
And equally enforced for that
yes,
matter.
Yes, and equally enforced. But in this case, like, the laws, the vast majority of traffic laws, I will say, I will not say all of them, but the vast majority of traffic laws, especially the ones governing what you can do on the road, when and where, are there for safety. They are there because we have figured out that we are traveling in boxes that are powered by explosions at speeds way faster than we could ever reach naturally. And that comes with some restrictions because you can't naturally operate in a totally immediate thinking way there. You have to do things. You have to be able to rely on how some things are going to happen so that you can focus on stuff that does that happens that's not supposed to and how you can react to it safely. So obviously these large groups should be following the rules of the road. They are not in these videos. There are, I think, different priority levels of how they're not following the road. I think taking up an entire lane of traffic is nowhere near as important as driving on the wrong side of the road into oncoming traffic. And even, you know, the taking up an entire lane could be a reasonable inconvenience in order to make a protest effective, especially if it's about bike infrastructure. But there are limits. Don't do things that are going to put you or anybody else involved in your event or other people who are not involved at risk. Just don't do it. It's not hard.
Now, I'm also going to do a sidebar because, you know, ADD. You talked about essentially heavy vehicles with internal combustion engines that can't think for themselves. It's worth noting that before you had internal combustion engines, you had animals.
Yes.
And when we had animals, there were rules of the road so that the animals could kind of predict what to expect without being alarmed.
Yeah.
I will also mention that until Henry Ford, Americans drove on the right. I'm sorry, on the left, rather.
Really?
Yes. If you watch old Westerns, you'll notice that they're always driving the buggy or the carriage or the wagon from the right-hand seat.
Huh.
And that actually goes at least as far back as Roman times. And the reason that the British still drive on the left is because when you're driving an animal, usually your whip is in your left hand and your reins are in your right hand. And if you're driving on the right-hand side of the road, you might accidentally hit oncoming traffic with your whip.
Interesting. Okay.
The reason, and if you look at really old movies of like New York City, like from early 1900s, you'll notice cars are kind of moving around. They're like on the right side, they're on the left side, the animals are like confused. What eventually settled it was when Henry Ford happened to find that it was just cheaper for him to put the steering wheel on the left side. And that eventually determined which side of the road we drove on. And because the U.S. auto industry ended up being the biggest soonest, that kind of decided how most of the rest of the world went.
Interesting. Okay. That's, yeah.
Little trivia that you can only get here randomly.
Well, I should check, do my due diligence. Are you sure that that is that A, we used to drive on the left, not the right, and B, that that is the reason why we used to drive on the left?
I'm as sure as I can be.
You're sure as you can be. Okay.
Which is about as sure as anybody can be.
Sure.
But I mean, from observing, from reading, from trivia, from a little history, from watching old films, I'm as sure as I can be that, yes, in fact, that is a true story. Well, of course, now there's another one that I'm not sure is so true, but maybe, that the diameter of a shuttle booster rocket was determined by Roman chariots.
Okay.
So Roman roads were built for Roman chariots.
Mm-hmm.
And when railroads were developed, they basically conformed to this same width because tunnels and everything were already built for that.
Okay.
And a booster rocket, anything really, can't be any bigger than will fit on a train through a tunnel.
Sure.
Hence, the diameter of a shuttle booster rocket is determined because of its transportation by a Roman chariot and the road that was built to take it.
A potential complication with that is that there do exist different gauges of rail track, which is perhaps one of the reasons why you can't be 100% sure of this, but it's not impossible.
It's not impossible, and the gauge of the track is not necessarily the width of the car. You can have a narrower gauge track with a wider car. Of course, that would mess with the center of balance.
Yeah.
But center of gravity, rather. But, you know, I mean, I'm not as sure of this as I am of the other.
Yeah, but
there are certain aspects of it that kind of make sense.
Yeah, but to get us off of our tangent, just when you're on the road, do what makes sense and do what's safe, please. Please.
And you might even try going to my blog post at thinkwingradio.com and clicking on the TxDOT rules and regulations for cycling. Mm-hmm. And that might also be eye-opening because, yeah, there are rules that admittedly should be equally enforced. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2 airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also listen at kpft.org if you're not in the local area. You can podcast it, which I suggest. You can also go to archive.kpft.org in order to listen to older shows, not only from Think Wing Radio, but one of the more or less 100 other shows on KPFT. Now, every story that we refer to on the show is usually very heavily excerpted, some dramatically so. So I do link to the full articles on my blog. I think I'm the only person that does talk radio that essentially posts my script. So you can hold me to account on it. You can refer to the same sources I'm referring to. You can go to thinkwingradio.com. You can go to today's show post or a prior one. You can use the search window to use keywords or dates. We're also on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, or look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio because I have no imagination, and Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
I don't think you make stupid jokes on this show.
I do it a lot less than I do on Twitch, that's for sure.
Are we grateful for that, or are we being, like, denied?
I think it probably a bit of both, to be honest. I have some good ones, but I have some real stinkers.
Well, just remember, anything you do on the radio is public.
Yep, and so is anything I do on the internet, to be fair.
There is that, but it doesn't involve me.
It doesn't involve you, yeah.
Okay, from ABC13.com, artists working to beautify utility and 5G boxes across Houston. Now, I have a reference picture. You'll have to go to the article link and the videos to see the differences. But basically, the pictures I have, it looks somewhat like a utility box. It's kind of a very light greenish, lightish green. Looks kind of like a utility box that they put on a city easement. And then next to that, for my own reference, and you can see at the video, they have a box that has been, quote unquote, beautified, which, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. So this is the way the article goes. Ever since 5G boxes showed up in Houston, they've been blasted by homeowners who say the boxes are an eyesore. The boxes are probably here to stay, so why not make them more appealing? Cell phone companies call them ground furniture, and the boxes are used to make internet and cell phone data run faster. Elia Quiles with Up Art Studio has plenty of experience turning ugly utility boxes into something communities can be proud of. Quiles and the city of Houston have partnered to turn hundreds of plane control boxes into public works of art. ABC 13 contacted Verizon about their 5G boxes, and the company said it had been in talks with the city to allow visual improvements to the boxes, but ultimately things fell through. You can find many ideas on how to make utility boxes less of an eyesore online, from planting shrubs, which I would suggest, near the boxes, or to putting up a lattice around them, which alternatively, personally, I would suggest. But Quiles says whatever you dream up, be sure to contact the company that owns the boxes first, because the boxes are powered by electricity and you don't want to get hurt or damage the gear. My personal curmudgeonly opinion, since art is in the eye of the beholder, you know, there's one thing about utility boxes, and that is your eye kind of adapts to them because they're relatively plain looking. And as I mean, the point of art is, on some level, to be noticed, appreciated, disliked, or whatever, but to be noticed. So the two pictures that I have as my reference side by side, which unfortunately would be challenging to upload and bandwidth and stuff like that. But I have to tell you, the original one is kind of innocuous, not pretty, but innocuous. Whereas the other one is kind of hit you in your face. And this person is no Rembrandt or Monet. So now you've taken something that you don't love it, but you can kind of learn to see around it, to something that, oh, my Lord, every time I go out and look at that, it just hits me in the face and I hate it. Because let's face it, artists will tell you that the point of art is to inspire a reaction. Mm-hmm. And the point of ground furniture is to inspire no reaction whatsoever. Fair. That's why they don't make it say neon orange. So I would ask, and I've seen so-called beautified boxes around town. I don't want to notice the box. I don't want my eye drawn to it, even for nice artwork, which occasionally it is, but usually not so. So just please leave our utility boxes alone. Don't. Andrew?
I am perhaps a little bit more fun than you when it comes to this.
Well, I said curmudgeonly. I was honest.
I know. And hey, I appreciate it. I am willing to have 5G boxes, utility boxes, whatever, be decorated by artists if the people who have those boxes in their front yards get final say over what the artist puts on the box. And if, you know, they don't want anything on the box, they have the right to say that. Or if they just want it painted a more camouflagey shade of green or whatever, if they have the right to make that choice. I think, you know, sometimes it gets a little complicated because it may be in a more communal space, and then you ask the people who live nearby what they want and that sort of thing. But I think that generally this is potentially an avenue for community showcase of artwork, maybe local artists, maybe artists who are famous, if they want to, you know, make a utility box
just
in Houston.
Dig Rembrandt up from the grave and see what he can do.
Yeah. But
I have to tell you, the one piece, and really we're running a little long on our early stories, but the one piece that I that really struck me is the decorated so-called utility box. There is one part of it is a picture of a pickup truck that would make any fifth grader proud. And if I had to look out my window at that every day, it would just,
well,
I mean, it really is not what you would call good art, at least not for a public space.
It's not what you would call good art. And that's the point here, is different strokes for different folks. And that's a legitimate art style. But if you live next to it, you should have the right to say, I don't want to see that. So fair enough.
Okay. Next story is kind of a little related to this, but in a totally opposite way. From thecron.com, Texas gun store ads were posted on a Houston school near an NRA event. The Austin firearms retailer promoted in the now removed advertisements is listed as an exhibitor at the NRA annual meeting in Houston. Ads for a Texas firearms retailer were placed on a high school just blocks away from where the NRA is holding its annual meeting, or was in Houston this weekend. The promotional signs for Silencer Shop, an Austin-based store that specializes in firearm suppressors and accessories, were posted on utility boxes, interestingly enough, at the Kinder High School for the Performing and Visual Arts, according to the school's assistant principal, Sean Tellez. Tellez posted a photo of the ad on Twitter, and I do have a link to that, writing, I get that those are Houston, Texas utility boxes, but get this nonsense off our block. Our kids shouldn't see stuff like this slapped around because we live and learn two blocks from where the NRA insists on having their convention. Tellez, in an email statement to the Kron, said he and one of the school's secretaries discovered the posters early Friday morning when they arrived on campus. The bright red ads were posted on city utility boxes on all four corners of the school, as well as utility boxes across the street, he said. School staff members have since removed the ads. According to Tellez, our initial concern and response was that we did not want our students seeing these posters as they arrived on campus, as many were already nervous and on edge. He said, I snapped the picture because it struck me as incredibly gross and insensitive for someone to post that there when you look just above and know you're posting it outside of a high school. The posters were applied with an adhesive that was, of course, difficult to remove, Tellez said. Well, I enhanced that. Our custodians and administrators began scraping what we could so the words could not be seen, Tellez said. Later, some good Samaritans came by and began assisting completely removing the residue. However, many students and parents took note of the posters before they were removed and were disgusted and upset, Tellez said. Less than a mile away from the high school, the NRA is holding its convention just days after an 18-year-old gunman killed 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. Additional HISD police officers were assigned to the Tellez's school, and extra school administrators and staff were closely monitoring the campus in light of the convention and the tragedy in Uvalde, Tellez said. He says, we continued to monitor the perimeter of campus as we were not sure what to expect with the convention and protests planned in response. Being a school in such a unique location, we are used to being near demonstrations. Thankfully, Tellez said the events have remained calm and students were able to complete the school day and participate in evening events Friday without disruption. He is not aware if Houston ISD is investigating the incident at this time. The Silencer Shop, which also sells weapons manufactured by Daniel Defense, the brand that canceled its appearance at the NRA convention and shut down its social media accounts after being linked to Tuesday's massacre, is listed as an exhibitor at the event. The store did not immediately respond to a request for comment by the time of the writing of this article. I did, because I'm that kind of a person, I did tweet to Assistant Principal Tellez, if you have not already done so, you should officially report this to City of Houston. The utility boxes are city property. Just because the ads are in spray paint doesn't mean that the law wasn't broken defacing public property. That's a crime. So, you know, again, it's like one person's free enterprise advertising is another person's traumatic reminder that a gunman can go into their school with an AR-15 with a 30-round clip at any moment.
Yep.
So, absolutely. You know, freedom takes responsibility, too.
Yeah. I mean, this is totally inappropriate for totally inappropriate content for near a school. It just it shouldn't be there. And it was kind of ambiguous to me in this article. Those utility boxes do not have advertising space. They are not rented out as advertising space. This was a poster or several posters stuck to several utility boxes without permission, presumably without contacting the city. Certainly without contacting the school, obviously. And so there is literally no legal defense for what happened here. Now, I don't say that to, you know, say that it was wrong because it was illegal. I say that it is illegal and it is wrong. Therefore, the law should – the people who object to it should be encouraged to use the law to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, essentially. You know, it's unclear, as you say from the article, whether this constitutes public property, city-owned, or whether it constitutes private property, meaning utility-owned, that happens to have an easement on city property. Mm. But in either case, it's defacement of either public or private property. And in either case, that's technically a misdemeanor, I believe, crime.
Yeah, use the tools that are available to you. So.
Yeah. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, if that sounds familiar, because you might have done that recently. you can hear us online at kpft.org. If you can't get us on the air from an HD radio, you can also podcast it, my suggestion, or you can visit archive.kpft.org to hear prior shows of both this series and like 100 other shows on KPFT. KPFT does have over 100 titles, and that means we need community support in order to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage and hit donate. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, whether it's large, small, or in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Also, word of mouth helps, so don't be afraid to tell your friends if there are shows, whether talk or music, that you find particularly interesting that you think they might enjoy as well. Okay, our next story, COVID-19 numbers rising according to Houston wastewater testing. This is from KHOU.com. Omicron variants BA.4 and BA.5 have also been detected for the first time in Houston wastewater. The wastewater testing is showing a viral load on May 16th that was 170% compared to July of 2020. The positivity rate is now at 11%. Which is to say, I guess, the human positivity rate. The wastewater testing shows that levels have been rising since the end of March. There is an interactive map that I have included a link to. The interactive map lets you go back through the entire pandemic to see what the levels were like at various times. The website also tracks the wastewater at Houston schools, several schools showing positive COVID samples in their wastewater. For those that don't know, it was found a few months into the pandemic that by testing wastewater for viral load, you can get a heads up in terms of what kind of illness level you might be seeing, how many people might be hospitalized, how many people might go to the ICU. It basically gives you a heads up on
the situation is on the ground, kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. That's a good fill-in. Anyway, so that kind of takes us into the next story. You know, Andrew and I have discussed how people that think the pandemic is pretty much over probably don't know anyone in the medical field. COVID was vanishing last Memorial Day. Cases are five times higher now. COVID-weary Americans enter summer with little effort to contain a still raging pandemic. This is from the WashingtonPost.com. For the third year, Americans are greeting the unofficial start of summer shadowed by the specter of the coronavirus amid rising COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations across the country. The United States is recording more than 100,000 infections a day, at least five times higher than this point last year, as it confronts the most transmissible versions of the virus yet. Immunity built up as a result of the record winter outbreak appears to provide little protection against the latest variants, new research shows. And public health authorities are bracing for Memorial Day gatherings to fuel another bump in cases, potentially seeding a summer surge. Now, it's worth noting here, we always think of the flu as a winter contagion. Now we have a summer contagion that we need to pay attention to that's even harder on people than the flu. Going back to the article, it's a far cry from a year ago. Back then, coronavirus seemed to teeter on the brink of defeat as cases plummeted to their lowest level since spring 2020 and vaccines became widely available for adults. Even the vaccinated and boosted now grudgingly accept the virus as a formidable foe that's here to stay as governments abandon measures to contain it. Parents of children too young to be vaccinated are making cross-country travel plans. Octogenarians are venturing to bars and families are celebrating graduations, weddings with throngs of mostly unmasked revelers, mindful they may get sick. Again, more than half of the U.S. population is living in areas classified as having medium or high levels of COVID by the CDC. The latest cases have yet to overrun hospitals, but that could change as the virus spreads among more vulnerable people. The dominant strains circulating in the U.S. are the most contagious thus far. According to Peter Hotez, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine, this one is really revved up, and it's probably getting up there with something as transmissible as measles. Over Memorial Day holidays, if you're in settings where you are indoors with large numbers of people without masks, there is a good likelihood you will suffer a breakthrough infection. An emerging body of research suggests Omicron infections will not confer lasting protection, as the virus's latest iterations show remarkable ability to escape immunity. Experts say the recently infected, who also received booster shots, I among them, can count on at least several months of immunity, while the unvaccinated should expect little protection. Experts say vaccines are still showing durability in protecting people against severe illness, but the initial burst of antibodies from shots or infections fades after several months, said Celine Gounder, an infectious diseases specialist and senior fellow at Kaiser Health News. That means the virus can develop into an infection before the body's immune system kicks in, even if you get a vaccination. For most Americans, coronavirus has faded from the foreground. More than half say they are not too concerned or not at all concerned with coronavirus, according to a May survey by Monmouth University. Nearly three quarters say they hope to vacation this summer, and less than a third say coronavirus is a major factor in their plans, according to a recent Washington Star Char School poll. I think it's Char or Scar. At a Southeast Portland pub, George Cummings, 85, took a leap of faith as he joined his friends from a local mountaineering and climbing club for drinks. He knows he's at a higher risk because of his age and wears a mask at the grocery store. He said he has not received a second booster because his doctor had not told him they were available. He went maskless as he drank lemonade, ate a cheeseburger, and mingled with a group of two dozen in the crowded bar. Said Cummings, who lives alone and had suspended his social life for the better part of 2 years, I'm not sure I'm 100% comfortable with my decision, but the alternative was not to go to the event. It's almost a question of, do you want to live, and that includes some sort of social life for a human being, or am I going to hide in my basement? So tough choices here. You know, I think if more people took steps, masking, distancing, hand washing, it's at a point, I'm sure, where we'll never completely defeat it, but there's no reason why we have to be constantly exposed to it at this level. So this is a human choice, basically.
Yeah. I'm in sort of a similar situation as George Cummings there, because I have started going to events again, even though I know that COVID isn't over. And I know that, you know, it's there are still people out there getting severely ill and dying from it. And unfortunately, the reality I realized was that other people are holding these events. And if I'm going to go to them, or if I'm going to not miss out on them, I'm going to have to go to them. And there's just no way around that. And it's unfortunate because I'm not fully comfortable with it either. I would honestly, I don't think that we ever fully properly locked down. I would still be up for a full proper lockdown where, you know, we actually limit people to essential work, not fast food workers. Not
2 weeks of quarantine pretty much would substantially eliminate it, at least to the point where it was more or less under control.
Yeah, two weeks of actual quarantine, not quarantine with a few, but in what is reality, a boatload of exceptions for any particular industry that the governor likes, you know, this sort of thing.
Basically not a blue state quarantine with a red state no quarantine. It would have to be like a red, white, and blue quarantine.
And I mean, you know, speaking of the national level, I mean, I think there are other countries that have had more successful pandemic responses. I think that China and Vietnam come to mind. But I think that the difference there is that those countries have a more consolidated governance structure, whereas in the U.S., we have the federal level, yes, but the federal level has to have the state compliance. And if the state governments don't comply, the entire system is nowhere near as effective. And so what we really need in the U.S. is for people in state governments to take the pandemic seriously, as seriously, or perhaps even more seriously, than the people at the federal level. But to do that, we'd have to vote different people in, wouldn't we?
I have to say something that really is only tangentially related to this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned red and blue, and then I mentioned red, white, and blue. And something occurred to me that I had never considered before, that I haven't mm-hmm. heard. Maybe other people have thought of it. First of all, do you know why we have so-called red states and so-called blue states? Have I ever told you this story?
They're considered safe for one party or the other.
No. In the days of black and white television, they only showed as shades of gray.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the blue and the red were sufficiently different that they could show Republican states and Democratic states.
Ah,
but here's what I just thought of. We have red, white, and blue stripes. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that that's kind of ironic in very partisan times like this, because you have the red stripes and you have the blue stripes, but you have the white peace stripes in between.
Just
something that kind of occurred to me.
So perhaps instead of purple states... Well, no, I'm not going to finish that thought. No, that doesn't sound good at all. No. I take it back.
Well,
never mind.
We have
never mind.
Predominantly white states, but they're not necessarily peaceful. I'm just saying.
I
know you didn't want to go there, but I'm older than you, and I'm not going to lose.
Moments where you speak without thinking, brought to you by Thinkwing Radio.
Well, but that assumes that I didn't think about it for a moment before I said it, which is why I tried to frame it in a way that was a little more realistic than perhaps misinterpretable.
I was talking about me, but okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, no, you stop yourself. So, in fact, you didn't speak without thinking. And, by the way, it's always worth remembering the new expression that Googling before typing is the new thinking before speaking.
True.
Yep. More people need to remember that. You are listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11, also online at kpft.org live, or you can podcast it, which I suggest, or you can go to archive.kpft.org to listen to prior shows as well as some of the 100 other shows that are on the station. We do heavily excerpt pretty much every story on the show, which is why we include links to full articles at thinkwingradio.com. We're also on social media, where we take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig. And look for me on Twitter at Thinkwing Radio, where sometimes I'm a little edgier. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
The next article I'm reading is an opinion piece that I do not necessarily endorse, by Egberto Willis, who does Politics Done Right on KPFT, as well as his own podcast. And I'm just going to read it with very little excerpted. I am voting solely for Democrats. They can win it all if we trade tunnel vision for strategy. I want to be very frank. I am very upset at our Democrats. Before rank-and-file Democrats stop reading here, don't. Egberto goes on, I am as progressive as one can get. I am a Democrat because in a duopoly, that is the only place I can reside quasi-comfortably. I will be voting for every single Democrat I have the opportunity to vote for because the Republican politicians, led by an ideology that kills and impoverishes, are a clear and present danger to us all, Democrat, independent, Republican, and otherwise. We must continue to live to fight another day. Fascism is a one-way valve that, once installed, we can only dislodge with a revolution. Nobody ever prepares for it any time. So again, I will hold my nose and vote for many that do not deserve my vote. Most importantly, I'll work feverishly to elect them. Just as feverishly, I will work to get more progressives who put the middle class first in 2024. You see, one cannot sit back in any election cycle. One must continue to engage, educate, encourage, and empower those we want to vote for our causes every day of every single week of every single month of every year. We can decide to penalize Democrats because they did not fulfill all of the promises they had the power to achieve. We can also understand the political game and work to kick out those who obstruct now in 2024 and replace them with those who unabashedly support the middle class. I, Egberto says, choose the latter. Those who do not have any interest in improving their lives have all the time in the world if they know we will eventually give up and leave the game. I, Egberto says, won't, nor should you. This was an opinion piece written by Egberto Willis that I simply read FYI. Andrew?
Before I start, I don't want to say I like Egberto. I know him. We've talked, and he's a good guy. I know his heart's in the right place. But unfortunately, I disagree with his methods. I disagree with his methods. I should actually say things on the radio instead of mumbling. I think this piece is
sometimes
really,
mumbling is the safest course of action when you're talking politics.
I think this piece is a classic example of a lesser evil argument. I think that Republicans are a threat. I agree with him on that because of their ideology, capitalism. I think, unfortunately, Democrats share that ideology, but they're more moderate about it. That makes them a lesser evil than the Republicans are. Republicans' prejudice and backslide into fascism, I believe, is in service of capitalism. And while it is a threat, because Democrats share the core ideology of capitalism, there is no guarantee that they won't go the same direction. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but eventually.
Or as Humphrey Bogart once said, but soon and for the rest of your life.
I was kind of trying to quote that. I did forget the quote.
Thank Casablanca.
You. Yes. I think that the best chance to avoid that backslide into fascism is a left-wing anti-capitalist party. I know it's not guaranteed. I know parties can be co-opted. It's happened before. But I think a major reason for the backslide, the underlying ideology, would not be present with an anti-capitalist left-wing party.
Well,
I'm almost done. I acknowledge the difficulty of getting one in power because of the duopoly, but I think that voting for a duopoly party won't make it any easier. Mike?
You can tell I can hardly wait, right? You mentioned that both parties are pro-capitalist. Mm-hmm. I think we're at a stage in our history where that is not entirely accurate. I think that Democrats are pro-capitalist with varying degrees of socialism in their political positions. I think that at this point, the Republican Party as a party is more about crony capitalism. And it's more about oligarchies, and it's more about enriching the rich to impoverish the poor. I don't see both parties as being equally pro-capitalist anymore. I mean, to some extent, they never were completely equally pro-capitalist, but I don't think that the difference has ever been this far, where one is essentially turning toward autocracy and cronyism and oligarchies, whereas at least the Democrats want essentially a democratic republic with, again, depending on whether it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or whether it's Schiff or somebody else, varying degrees of socialism, a mixed economy, essentially. So I think distinctions matter, and sometimes nuances are real.
My one short response to that is, it is my belief that capitalism of any type leads to what is called crony capitalism. But I do agree with you that the Democrats and Republicans are not the same type of capitalist. One is, I think, better than the other. But, you know, it's the same thing in the end, I think.
So here we are, just varying degrees of the Venn diagram, which I always find intriguing. All right, the next story. I did a lot of research trying to find good stats. I mean, there were a lot of charts and numbers, but they didn't usually have good stats. So this is what I came up with. It's called Crime in the United States for 2011. Why 2011? Because I couldn't find any government site that had anything later than that broke it down the same way. Partly, I think that's because Republicans have spent decades trying to prevent funding of federally collected statistics on shootings as either criminal statistics or health crisis statistics from the CDC, for example. So I think there are tables, like I said, these things are excerpted and there are links and you can reference them and you can dig a lot deeper. And I've even included five references at the end after the chart, which I have managed to include in my blog post. But yep, I think
that's at thinkwingradio.com/posts-page, just for your reference.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to just grab some numbers here. In 2011, in incidents of murder for which the relationships of murder victims and offenders were known. Now, this is aimed, in my opinion, at people who think that keeping a gun makes them safer. 54.3% of murder victims were killed by someone they knew, an acquaintance, neighbor, friend, boyfriend, etc. 24.8% of victims were killed by family members. The relationship of murder victims and offenders was known in about 44% of murder and non-negligent manslaughter incidents in 2011. Of the female murder victims for whom the relationships to their offenders were known, 36.5% were murdered by their husbands or boyfriends. Of the murders for which the circumstance surrounding the murder was known, 42.9% of victims were murdered during arguments, including romantic triangles. Felony circumstances, including rape, robbery, burglary, etc., accounted for 23.1% of murders. Circumstances were unknown for 38% of reported homicides. And then there's a chart that, again, has a lot to unpack. This is percent distribution volume by relationship. So they have a pie chart, and then alongside that, they have numbers. So of the numbers for 2011, husbands, this is now victims. Husbands were victims in 108 cases. Wives were victims in 552 cases. Mothers, 123. Fathers, 130. So parents pretty much killed in equal numbers. Sons were killed at a rate of 263. Daughters only 182. Brothers, 86. Sisters, 29. Other family members, which can be like in-laws, cousins, uncles, aunts, 279. Among those who are known by acquaintance, 2,700 were victims. 377 were victims of friends, 161 boyfriends, 474 girlfriends, 107 neighbors, 10 employees, and 14 employers. So the number of people that, or as a percentage or as an absolute number, of people that actually ended up protecting themselves by having a gun is much smaller than the number of people they have either threatened in terms of suicide, family disputes, neighborly disputes, accidental weapons discharges, and all these other things that get involved that have nothing to do with defending yourself but are actually endangering yourself. Andrew?
I think there are two things for me to say here. The first is that I agree with you that it is bad that these statistics have not been updated since 2011. I think it is bad that Republicans are standing in the way of them being collected. I would prefer as health crisis statistics rather than crime statistics. I think one would be less biased than the other. But I think that, yeah, we, in order to make good policy decisions and in order to make good personal decisions, we need reliable data. And if somebody's preventing that data from being collected, how can we be expected to make good decisions? I think to the data that we do have, from what I've seen here, it is not explicitly mentioning hate crimes. And I think for me, hate crimes are a significant portion of why I am pro-gun ownership.
Well, what it says is people known to each other, which does not preclude hate crimes.
Doesn't
it could
preclude.
Be neighbors. It could be in-laws.
You're right. You're right.
So it could be wrapped up in here in just a different way, not broken out separately.
But in certainly
but
in the
should
age
be,
of,
I'll agree.
Yeah, but certainly in the age of the internet, I think that a hate crime can just as easily be committed against you. And this is anecdotal and based on assumptions, I'll admit that. But I think that if you are a person from a community that faces hate crimes, you can just as easily be a victim of somebody who is a stranger as somebody who knows you.
I also mentioned that I don't think there's any place here that discusses killings by police.
Yes.
In terms of either homicides or manslaughter or anything like that. This is,
yeah.
I would determine civilians is my inference.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, even with all this in front of me, I would say, you know, I am still not saying, I'm not saying don't buy a gun, but I'm also not saying assume you need a gun. I recently went out with a left-wing gun club, and one of the things that was made very clear to me in the fundamentals course was guns aren't right for everyone. There are non-lethal methods of defending yourself, like pepper spray, like loud whistles, like tasers, these sorts of things that have that are at the very least less lethal, if not non-lethal. And those can be very viable alternatives. So I am not saying that everybody should be armed. I am saying that the people who it is right for, who feel it is right for them, should be able to be armed, and everybody should know how to use a gun, you know, competently.
Use the weapon of their choice competently.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to insert here that except for the whistle possibility, pepper sprays and tasers are also considered weapons.
Yes.
And anytime you discharge a weapon at somebody, whether it's a firearm or a taser or a pepper spray or any kind of weapon, a nunchuck, mm-hmm. You are going to have to account for it with the police, particularly if there is any kind of injury that might be considered a negligent injury. So keep in mind, you know, A, you want to defend yourself.
Yeah.
B, there may be some legal stuff you'll have to go through for having done that. So think carefully. Think carefully before you defend yourself, so you've kind of mentally rehearsed the circumstances under which you'll use various kinds of self-defense measures, whether it's running or pepper spraying.
Yeah, and I would advise do that mental rehearsement before you get in a situation where you feel you need to defend yourself.
Yeah, you don't want to say, time out, let me think about this.
Yeah, in the moment.
Time back in.
Yeah, in the moment, as unreliable and not ideal as it is, gut instinct may be your best bet. Maybe.
You know, one of the analogies, I know we're running over time. One of the analogies that I'm going to make is when you watch athletes, they've been trained to visualize what they're going to do before they do it, because it is felt that the visualization helps to prepare their bodies and their muscles for the activity they're about to participate in. You don't have the opportunity to visualize right before your high jump.
Yeah.
But mental rehearsals mean a lot. And as a matter of fact, I have seen there's at least one kind of pepper spray that's available that for the purchase of the pepper spray, you also get a rehearsal canister that does not have pepper that allows you to practice exactly what it feels like to discharge it, how to arm it, how to discharge it, how to aim it, what the force is like. And I think if you're going to get a pepper spray, look for something like that where you can actually get a feel for it. That's part of that rehearsal.
Mm.
You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Station 90.1 KPFT HD2 with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. Hope you've enjoyed the show, found it interesting. We'll be back next week. Take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together? And find the place that's safe and warm. It's not too late. We should be giving.
Some stations in Texas have lost their local announcers. Some cities even use a national music service to bring a limited variety of music to their communities and have lost that connection to their towns. Houston is lucky. KPFT is programmed by your neighbors, folks who live down the street from you, folks that you know. KPFT knows what's going on in the community and reflects performances that happen right here. Become a sustaining member today and keep KPFT local. Your donation at 713-526-5738 makes it all possible. Please call now. That number is 713-526-5738. Or if it's more convenient, use our website, kpft.org. And while you're there, listen in. And thank you.
KPFT has been a staple in the Houston area and surrounding communities for over 50 years. With an amazing volunteer staff, we are able to produce exclusive programming that you cannot hear anywhere else. From every genre to the local current affairs programs, our volunteers give 100% to the communities in which we serve. As KPFT continues to evolve, we ask for your input, and we ask that you support the arts, music, news, international news, and current affairs that you've come to know and love. With your support, we've been able to grow our programming and serve our communities more now than ever before. As time changes, isn't it good to know that you have a community station that does too? If you have not sent in your contribution to KPFT, now is a perfect time to do just that. Go online to kpft.org. Giving could never be easier. Thank you for your support of Houston's community station for over 50 years.